This is 1A. I'm Celeste Headley in Washington, sitting in for Joshua Johnson. There were some huge stories developing as we headed into the holidays, and maybe at that point you turned off the news, turned away from the news, or tuned out completely. But all that stuff was still happening, so I hope you're ready to catch up. Here to help us understand some of the headlines we may have missed is Ron Elving. He's senior editor and correspondent for NPR. It's good to have you, Ron, as always.
Good to be with you, Celeste.
Also in the studio is David Preece. He's the chief operating officer of Lawfare Institute, a former CIA officer, and the author of How to Get Rid of a President, History's Guide to Removing Unpopular, Unable, or Unfit Chief Executives. Hello, David.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
And joining us from NPR in New York is Alexandra Jaffe. She's a correspondent with Vice News Tonight on HBO. Hey, Alexandra.
Thanks for having me.
So let's begin with the shutdown. That is how the president started, tweeting the following: "We will be forced to close the southern border entirely if the obstructionist Democrats do not give us the money to finish the wall and also change the ridiculous immigration laws that our country is saddled with." End quote. The shutdown is getting ready to enter the second week, but it appears that the Republicans and Democrats are more dug in than they were before Christmas. So, Ron, how does this end? What's the various scenarios here?
Probably not soon would be the first answer. Probably not soon. Congress is technically back, but they're not here and there are no votes scheduled. We don't expect to see the Republican House reconvene. So the 115th is in the rearview mirror. The 116th Congress convenes next week. The Democrats will be in charge of the House. They are determined not to give President Trump the funding that he wants for the wall. There is money for border security, as there has been in all past years, and it is an amount similar to what was negotiated before and, frankly, what was negotiated in December. But the president ran into a problem with his base supporters late in the month or mid-month and decided that the deal that they had made to keep the government open wasn't good enough, sent Mike Pence up to the Hill to tell the Republican leaders that was the new marching orders. The Senate had already passed unanimously a deal to keep the government open into February,
yeah.
Already passed unanimously in the House that is in the chamber that has both Democrats and Republicans. In the House where the Republicans were in control, they just simply dug in their heels and said, no, the president doesn't want us to pass this.
So you say it's not going to end soon. Here's what President Trump said from the Oval Office on Wednesday when he was asked about it.
I can't tell you when the government's going to be open. I can tell you it's not going to be open until we have a wall, a fence, whatever they'd like to call it. I'll call it whatever they want.
Alexandra, do you agree that this is going to go on for some time, and why?
It does seem like it's an indefinite shutdown because we haven't seen any negotiations between the two sides at any point during this break, and there's no sort of plan to get back at the negotiating table when we see Congress come back. That said, with Democrats in charge of the House, part of what's been holding this up is the hardline House conservatives, the House Freedom Caucus. And now that Democrats are taking back control of the House, there may be a better chance to pass sort of a compromise that, you know, both parties agree on. The compromise that the Senate passed before with bipartisan support will be easier to get through the House. And then it'll be tougher for Trump to sort of have that on his desk and not sign it.
We have a message here from Steve in New Hampshire who says, does the shutdown include White House staff? Is he the least bit inconvenienced? It would be nice to know he wasn't being waited on while he forces so many others to sacrifice so much. For the record, I'm not directly affected. And I wonder, David, if some of the polls that are coming out might sway the president. We've seen that he sometimes is most influenced by what's happening on TV.
Right. I don't see it really affecting him much because of what the listener just mentioned, which is the fact the president is not inconvenienced by this. Everything around the president, including everything from intelligence briefings to White House support, carries on as if nothing is different. He's still watching TV the same he always has. He's still probably getting calls from concerned congressmen. Nothing seems to have changed for the president. Who it has changed for is hundreds of thousands of federal employees, but President Trump has shown no empathy for those employees. What he has shown instead is, am I going to, quote, win or not? A win for him at this point probably would ultimately be a way out whereby he gets border security money, he claims it's wall money when it's not, and then the government can reopen.
Since you mentioned the people who are affected, rent payments are going to be coming due on Tuesday, food bills adding up, I'm sure, insurance premiums coming due, business owners are losing appointments from government workers, the Alaskan sled dog puppy live video feed by the National Park Service offline. People are sharing personal experiences on Twitter. They're using the hashtag #ShutdownStory. So, Ron, what kind of appetite does the American public have for these continued stories of government workers who are without pay?
I don't think people find that enjoyable. I don't think people are going to be happy to learn if they're coming to Washington for a post-New Year's Day visit or if student groups are coming, which they do at this time of year, that the Smithsonian is having to close all the museums, including, of course, the National Zoo, which is also run by that same apparatus. The government has sent out letters to the furloughed employees and those who are working without pay, saying, if you need this letter to show to your landlord or to your mortgage company, we're trying to explain that you will get your money eventually, but we can't give you any money now, and we'll see how that plays with those landlords and mortgage companies.
And in addition to that, the letter from OPM said, if you need legal advice, please consult your personal attorney. How many
OPM
federal
is the
employees?
Office of Personal Management.
Yes. How many federal employees have personal attorneys on retainer that they are going to go to for legal advice when they can't make a rent payment? It's simply not helpful to the average federal employee.
Alexander, we have a question from Julie on Facebook who writes, with a veto-proof majority, can Congress pass legislation to end the shutdown?
It's likely that they can pass a bill that will get to Donald Trump's sort of desk. It depends on how politically problematic this shutdown gets and how much it's affecting the country at that point. I mean, we haven't seen Republicans make that move, and it'll be up to Republicans in the Senate to overrule the president. So I don't know that there's any political sort of appetite among Republicans in the Senate to push an end to the shutdown. But if it's getting rough at that point, I mean, as you guys just mentioned, we're seeing issues for a lot of middle-class workers that are federal workers. So if the politics really do turn negative at that point, that may be a possibility. But at this point, I can't imagine Republicans would want to overrule the president.
The partial government shutdown will have far-reaching impact. There is one thing it will not affect, though. That's Special Counsel Robert Mueller's investigation into whether Russia interfered into the 2016 election. A listener asked us this question last week. We did not have an answer then, but after checking, the Justice Department confirmed that the Mueller investigation is funded from a, quote, permanent indefinite appropriation, end quote. So onward that goes. Another big story, and there's a lot to talk about here, is the border wall, which is obviously funding the dispute over the shutdown. That's not the only immigration story in the headlines right now. On Christmas Eve, 8-year-old Felipe Gomez Alonso, a detained migrant child from Guatemala, died after doctors had diagnosed him with a common cold. So, Alexandra, have we gotten more information about what led to this child's death?
Yes, DHS put out a release sort of walking through their version of the timeline. There's still not a lot of clarity about when this child fell ill, whether it happened before he came into, you know, Border Patrol custody, or whether it was truly when he was in custody. So there's some dispute over that. But the bigger issue is what DHS is blaming. In this release that they put out, they didn't quite take responsibility for, you know, the child's welfare. Basically, the release argued that it was the fault of the immigration system that's putting sort of too much pressure on staff and rewarding parents for bringing their children or sending minors unaccompanied, that's causing these, you know, sick kids to end up dying in CBP custody. So regardless of what happened in this particular case, it's clear that DHS and CBP are not ready to sort of take responsibility for it.
CBP, Customs and Border Patrol. And Ron, there was also a 7-year-old girl from Guatemala named Jacqueline Calmaquin, also died while being held by U.S. Customs and Border Protection. That was a few weeks ago. This must be a growing discussion between immigration forces and Border Patrol and even the CDC, as well as getting involved into what's happening. What can we expect here?
Investigations. There will be investigations internally within those agencies. And then, starting next week, with the Democrats being in control of the House, they will have gavels and with them subpoena power. They don't normally need subpoena power to investigate a agency of the federal government, and they bring people in. Generally speaking, they cooperate and come in. They don't always have to be subpoenaed. But they do have ultimately that kind of power. There is a real hammer here. And so there are going to be people who have to come in and give answers, and you're going to have chairs of these committees and subcommittees in the House who have some attitude about how the CBP has been operating, about how the Department of Homeland Security has been operating, and how the entire Trump administration has been operating. And so these cases, sadly, because they are personal tragedies, but nonetheless, they are also being caught up in this larger political issue, these individual cases are going to be adjudicated.
Alexandra, let's stay with immigration for just a moment, because this discussion over these children who have tragically died while in custody has to add into the years-long discussion over the treatment of children through the immigration system. And so I want to play you this comment that was made on Wednesday by U.S. Customs and Border Protection Commissioner Kevin McAleenan, who told CBS this morning that his agency needs a whole different approach when they're handling kids in custody.
I've explained to Congress, I've testified in this, I've talked about it publicly for months and months, that what we're seeing with these flows of huge numbers of families with lots of children, young children, as well as unaccompanied minors coming into Border Patrol custody after crossing the border unlawfully, that they're not, our stations are not built for that group that's crossing today. They were built 30, 40 years ago for single adult males, and we need a different approach. We need help from Congress. We need to budget for medical care and mental health care for children in our facilities, and I'm committed to improving our conditions, even as we work on the broader problems, border security, and of course, solving the issues in our legal framework that are inviting these families and children to make this dangerous journey.
So, Alexander, we also got a comment from the Department of Homeland Security Secretary Kirstjen Nielsen, who said, quote, in response to the unprecedented surge of children in our custody, I've directed a series of extraordinary protective measures. What changes might we see, or what changes are possible?
Well, she's currently having staff sort of do health checks for all of the children that are apprehended at the border to prevent sort of issues like we've been seeing, these deaths, from continuing. But as you know, you heard in that comment you just played, they don't have the staff for that. So there's currently talk of bringing in FEMA staff, bringing in HHS staff to help with those health checks. But at this point, I mean, there is some truth to the fact that they are not prepared for this influx of families and children. And Congress has no appetite for sort of fixing the problem. If they can't even figure out border security, funding for border security, they're not going to figure out how to sort of reimagine the policies at the border when it comes to these children. So even though there is a clear need for fixes, there's no sort of political appetite or end in sight for that.
So we got a comment from Linda, who's listening in Madison, Wisconsin, and writes, my greatest hope is that the Democrats show they can govern after 2 years of Republicans showing they cannot. I urge the Democrats to revive an earlier comprehensive immigration proposal, which includes a path to citizenship for DACA, pass it in the House, and send it to the Senate. Ron, you were talking about the fact that now that Democrats are taking control of House, they may begin investigating, but they don't actually have power to change policy.
They don't.
At CBP or immigration.
They do not. But what they can do, as the caller suggests, is they can frame a policy change. They can put it in legislative form. They can pass it. They will have the votes. The Democrats are expecting to be united enough to pass legislation of that kind, if not any kind of legislation. And then when it goes to the Senate, you have a robust debate, theoretically. Now, Mitch McConnell can say, we're not going to consider that bill, but there will be considerable pressure on him to consider that bill. And there will be committees where the Democrats can raise the subject and they can say, there's legislation that's pending, that's waiting for the Senate to consider it. And I think the country will want to see that debate.
Let's move on just a little bit to some more troubles for the White House, in this case specifically President Trump. He famously received a medical exemption from the Vietnam War after being diagnosed with bone spurs in 1968. But a new report from the New York Times says that diagnosis may have been made up. What was the bottom line here, David?
The idea in the reporting is that Fred Trump, the president's father, arranged for a medical exam that miraculously found bone spurs right at the time when Donald Trump would have been drafted and sent to Vietnam. I don't see this moving the needle much, because I don't see too many people who, even in 2016, before the election, heard about Trump's bone spur deferment. I don't know too many people who thought, Yep, that's 100% medically sound. I believe there was already baked in the belief that this was fraudulent in one way or another. Seeing the reporting to confirm that probably just reinforces the beliefs of those who already thought that was true, and those who don't want to believe it, they will find many excuses not to believe this, notably that I believe the doctor himself is dead. And these are reports coming from the children of the doctor.
And Alexander, we haven't really seen many of these stories that would have been detrimental maybe to another political figure move the needle on Trump supporters anyway, right?
Exactly. I mean, we've been talking about his draft deferment and the fact that he has no military experience since, you know, before the 2016 election. And it hasn't changed his base support, and that's what's driven him to success. So this detail on how that happened, I don't think is going to, you know, move the needle much. It's probably just going to have both sides digging their heels about how they feel about the president.
I would agree, but with this one reservation, which is that this news comes at a time when the president has to some degree set himself up against the military establishment, not only with the resignation of Secretary of Defense Mattis, with that extraordinary letter that he wrote in resigning, which someone described as a 21-gun, well, not salute, let's just say. And that is that has set off a number of retired people from the military who cannot be restrained the way people in the current military can to say what they think of this whole business and the way that Donald Trump treats the military and the way that he politicizes it. We saw some of this in Iraq during his visit with the politicization of his remarks to the troops that he was visiting.
It's not traditional for presidents to talk about politics when they're speaking to troops. It's a no-no.
Yeah. It's not the sort of thing you do. You emphasize your tribute to the troops and their service, and you talk about what unites us as a country, and that's what you talk about. You don't turn it into a political rally, and that is what happened in this particular instance. So with all of those things that are changing in terms of the president's relationship to the military, there's probably going to be at least a little erosion around the edges of that hard base of support among those people who feel more loyalty to the military than to him.
So, David, it feels like a million years ago that Jim Mattis stepped down as defense secretary. More than months ahead of schedule, President Trump has appointed Deputy Defense Secretary Patrick Shanahan to the top spot, at least in the interim. Mattis announced, as Ron referred, his resignation in a pretty scathing letter. How do we place this among what Ron is talking about, like an overall relationship with the military?
Well, it's a pattern even beyond the military. The president's relationship with all of the military, intelligence, and law enforcement has followed a pattern. We remember right after inauguration, he visited the Central Intelligence Agency, gave a speech in front of the Memorial Wall, where stars are carved into the wall to honor those who have died in service to their country, and he made it a political event. So I think the military visit is in line with that behavior. It's not the exception. It is the rule. The question is, does this affect his base's view? Because one thing that you see an overlap on are the president's base voters and support for the military. And if those circles are moving slightly apart, that is finally something where the president might have to pay attention to the consequences of his actions.
This week, the president and first lady spent a portion of Christmas Eve taking calls from America's kids, kids who are calling into NORAD Santa Tracker. That's a program that helps you track Santa as he makes his way around the globe. But that photo op took a little bit of a turn during a call from 7-year-old Coleman Lloyd. Here is some audio courtesy of the Charlton Post-Gazette.
Yes, sir.
Are you still a believer in Santa?
Yes, sir.
Because at 7, it's marginal, right?
Yes, sir.
Elker Ketcher, you guys say hi to Mr. President.
Enjoy yourself. Hi. Where are you from?
That was President Trump talking to a 7-year-old who'd called in to NORAD specifically to track Santa. Mom gets in there pretty quickly. Alexandra, Madison's resignation, maybe not touching the president, maybe none of this else, but what about it's Santa?
Of all of the comments he's made, you know, ruining Santa, ruining Christmas for a 7-year-old might be it. No, I think, you know, it adds to this perception of the president as not potentially being very open towards the cares and concerns of average Americans. I mean, the idea that he doesn't understand you can't ruin Santa for a seven-year-old. It's pretty remarkable, but also a little bit par for the course from what we've seen from him, from, you know, outlandish comments from everything from his former mistresses to, you know, Democrats that he's running against. So it's not surprising, but it is the kind of thing that's pretty universally a no-no. You don't go there, but he did.
Yes. Yeah. We're not going to ruin Santa. No, for any seven-year-olds who might be listening to the Friday News Roundup.
One could wonder whether this might, in some sense or another, hurt his base among seven-year-olds.
Right. Yeah. They're terrible at voting, though. They don't really get out to the polls.
Can't rely on them.
A more pleasant exchange involving the president and Christmas was a surprise visit to see U.S. troops in Iraq. It was his first trip to that country since his election. While he was there, he defended his decision to withdraw from Syria. We mentioned this before in terms of bringing politics into a visit to the troops. The president said it showed his commitment to keeping America first. He also told a lie. He said he'd given the troops their first raise in more than 10 years. Troops have gotten annual raises of up to 3.9% every year since 2007, according to the Pentagon. So, David, anything else you picked out of this visit that you thought was noteworthy?
Well, two things. First of all, several of the topics we've discussed point to the fact that there's not that simple foundation of a shared reality that a president normally has with those covering him in the media or calling in on the NORAD line, that there's just a fundamental difference in the way he approaches facts than others of his predecessors have. The other thing that struck me about the president's visit to Iraq was his reaction to the coverage of him signing the Make America Great hats. It was not, this is wrong. In fact, he doubled down on it in a tweet saying, you know, if these brave young people ask me to sign their hat, I will sign. Can you imagine my saying no? And then said, we brought or gave no hats.
Something else that didn't happen. For example, while he was there, Ron, the president did not meet with Iraqi's prime minister or really any Iraqi officials. Do we have any idea why he chose not to do that?
There are two versions of that. One is that they had to notify the Iraqi officials very late for security reasons, and one can understand that. They were very closely held information about this trip. They did not want any more people than absolutely needed to know to know. And so that is one supposed explanation. And then they had a little bit of a short time frame to set up the necessary security and everything that would have to be done. A couple of hours wasn't enough. So they decided to have a phone call instead. That's the official version. Then there is another version that suggests that they really just couldn't get together about how to do this. And the Iraqis had one view and we had another view. And that they just decided that it would be better not to have some sort of awkward meeting. And after all, the whole time down on the ground was only a few hours. So the president decided, let's just let it go at a phone call. Now, we don't know exactly what to say about that because we have the official version. We have some people throwing doubt and shadow upon that particular version. And we can also
True of the last 2 years, though, right?
We have to try to find our way in the shade that's been cast, right? So we will all probably reach our own conclusions.
It also reinforces the belief among many Iraqis and many in the Iraqi government that the United States is treating Iraq like a U.S. base at best or as U.S. territory at worst, when the president says something like, we don't need any troops in Syria because we'll just go at them from Iraq. And then he flies in, doesn't visit government officials, doesn't give much notice of even coming. It's the kind of thing that reinforces that narrative among the Iraqis.
Alexander, what do you make of the president's decision not just to have this be his first visit, but at Christmas time?
Well, we have to remember the context behind this. I mean, he's been criticized for months for not having visited the troops. There were even reports, anonymously sourced, but reports that he was scared or anxious about going to some of these war zones. So I think he chose this moment both because it's a good political photo op. I mean, you're visiting the troops around Christmas. That's a political tradition. And also because it doesn't get a lot of scrutiny at that time. It's sort of a slow news day, and he did it secretly. So it gives him some cover in case of gaffes. But obviously, we're talking about some of these gaffes right now. We're talking about the politicization of the meeting. But I do think that there was some concern about how the president would handle that. And that's why they chose the timing.
So We got a comment from Virginia in D.C. who writes, in an effort to distract from dismal news, Trump's tweets a selfie with SEAL Team 5 revealing their identities and breaching operational security. There's another thing to talk about. And then a question here for you, Ron. Michael writes, since Trump's election, there has been an increase in the defense budget of almost 10%. This money went to equipment, uniforms, food, salaries, etc. This is what Trump is referencing. Although the president specifically said a pay raise.
He said a pay raise. There have also been a lot of increases in Pentagon spending on things like weapon systems, like a new F-15 and so on. But all right, if you want to find something that has gone up, other than the pay that the military personnel receive, those things have gone up as well. I don't think that's exactly what the president was trying to get a positive reaction from his audience about. Telling them that there's more money for their uniforms is probably not going to get a big cheer. A pay raise, of course, did. And there's one other thing the president said while he was there about the United States no longer being suckers, no longer being the policemen of the world. That word suckers rubbed a lot of people the wrong way, because particularly some of the retired military officers who have been in charge in a number of the places we have been in recent years thought that that was disrespectful of all the troops who served in Afghanistan and Iraq and a number of other places, that the president was implying we went to that made us suckers, really, basically, to be there as their defenders, and also disrespectful to the people who died in those struggles.
Alexandria, did this visit, do you think, help or hurt the president's relationship with the military?
I mean, as both Ron and David mentioned, that relationship has been slipping. We've been seeing some criticism from generals of the way that he's handled the military. So having that photo op is worthwhile. But, you know, as we've also been talking about, there were some of these gaffes that probably rubbed some of the military wrong. This idea that we've been suckers in these wars that, you know, military service members have been fighting for years. So did it do more damage than good? Potentially, honestly. I mean, going out there and visiting them was a step in the right direction, but because he politicized the visit and because he criticized the military, essentially, while in front of them, that could cause some long-standing damage.
David, did you want to add just a quick comment on that? I see you nodding your head.
Yeah, it seems to me that we keep coming back to this issue of the president not behaving as we expect presidents to behave. And after 2 years, some of the conversations are the very same ones we've had. It's just the details change. We shouldn't expect the president to change at this point. We should see what institutions with the new Congress adapt to the new political situation and respond.
Barbara writes on Facebook, I live and work for the federal government and I am furloughed. My husband works in the private sector, so we're lucky we still have some income. But in terms of the waste of taxpayer money, I want to make the point that it's not just the actual time lost from work during the shutdown, but also the time we spend planning for possible or actual shutdowns, and the time afterwards to get projects back on track is substantial. It diverts us from the work we're supposed to be doing, all at taxpayer expense, so incredibly dysfunctional. And then Julie writes this, so much is being said about furloughed government workers. Yes, they will get back pay when the government opens back up, but there are thousands of contract workers who support these agencies that are now not working, but will not get back pay when this ends. Our daughter is in this situation, and she will not be paid for all these days when this is all done. So we're about to talk about the economy. Something very weird going on in New York. As it turns out, it's not aliens landing. But Wall Street has had a very, very bad month, at the stock market at least. It was the second worst December in history, next to 1931 during the Great Depression. Christmas week was an incredible roller coaster ride going up and down. So what is fueling all this volatility, Ron? And I ask you this question first because I wonder if some of this is related to the shutdown.
It's possible. Certainly the shutdown caused, when it was first clear that there was going to be one, that caused one of the dips in the market. There are a number of other issues, and we shouldn't forget that among them is the fact that we're at the end of a historically long bull market that has taken the market to its highest levels ever during the past year. We've been setting record after record. So these descents, these drops, these vertiginous, dizzying drops that we've seen are down from a very high level. That's for starters. Also, the thing about it that's strange is that the economy is showing really great resilience and strength in the recovery that began in 2009, 2010, and that has continued through all this period of time, fueling the long bull market. So a lot of things are good. So what's causing this sudden volatility? Some of it is uncertainty about the relationship with China. because of the trade war that is going on already at one level and could escalate very quickly. Another is the sense of political volatility, that that the grown-ups have been leaving and that there is more of a sense that we don't know exactly what's coming next with respect to the investigations of the president. So there's a lot of political uncertainty about the next year or two, and that has also been an influence. Also, I think the president's criticism or abuse of the Federal Reserve Board chairman, that makes the market very uneasy. By and large, the market likes easy money, but they also like the sense that there is stability in the Federal Reserve, and particularly in the respect that is shown between the president and the supposedly non-political Federal Reserve Board chairman.
Alexandra, unless we see a gigantic rally today and Monday, the Dow will likely have its first year loss since 2015. And I wonder if there's any connection or correlation between the losses in the Dow and this being the first full year that the tax cuts went into effect.
Well, we haven't seen sort of the economic impact that Republicans promised from those tax cuts. We've seen actually businesses sort of reinvest those in stock buybacks, reinvest those in their sort of boards and owners, rather than the trickle-down effect of creating new jobs and increasing wages for middle-class Americans. But I don't know that that is, you know, what is particularly impacting the stock market. It's really, as Ron just mentioned, a lot of this volatility. And one of the ironies of this is Donald Trump is particularly frustrated with this because it's one of his biggest political advantages is the strength of the economy. But he's been undermining that to some extent by going after the Fed chairman with his tweets and sort of with his volatility, with his negotiations with China. So even as he'd like to sustain the strength of the economy that we saw sort of during his first year of his presidency, he's actually impacting that and undermining it.
We also can't rule out that the market, as a general rule, which dislikes uncertainty, has had built into it, if you will, a Jim Mattis buffer. And with Jim Mattis gone, we've talked a lot about the impact on national
security. You mean people were giving
security.
The benefit of the doubt because they thought Jim Mattis was the adult in the
room.
That
at least there was some stability in the international situation. But when you have uncertainty in domestic politics and perhaps increasingly in national security without the steadying influence of Jim Mattis in place, it might be that some of that volatility in the market rises to the surface without that buffer being there.
So we also had the Federal Reserve decided to raise interest rates again last week. And I wonder, well, there's been a feud between the Fed chairs, you alluded to, Ron, between the Fed chair Jerome Powell and President Trump over higher interest rates. And do we think it's possible that Powell will remain in his office next year?
Yes, he will still be a member of the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve. That can only be changed for cause, and there is no such cause. Just a difference about the policy is not a cause for removal. It is possible, and there's some debate over this, that the president could shift someone else into the chairmanship and
right.
displace Jerome Powell in that fashion and lessen his power, but he can't remove him from the board. It's extremely unlikely the president's going to do that. We assume that Steve Mnuchin, the Treasury Secretary, who is one of the adults, as they have been called, one of the grown-ups, one of the people who has been more responsible in terms of how he deals with people. A little scandal-ridden in his own right, but he was the guy the president wanted to have call and reassure investors, telling them, hey, we talked to the six largest banks, and they're all solvent, and there's money to lend, and everything's fine. Of course, that kind of, well, baby check unsolicited was more disturbing to investors perhaps than anything else and probably helped Monday be such a disaster.
Yeah, it's like saying, I checked on your dog, she's not dead.
Yeah.
That's upsetting.
Yeah, I didn't think my dog needed that check.
Right.
So there is some degree of feeling that Steve Mnuchin is going to restrain the president from his moments of thinking that Jerome Powell should be removed or in some sense demoted, and that we understand may have already happened a little bit, and so the president's piped down a tad about Powell.
So, Alexandra, what are we to make of the Christmas Eve efforts of Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin, clearly designed to reassure everyone? Is it fair to say it did the opposite?
I think that's absolutely fair because, as you just mentioned, there was no need for it. I mean, there was no concern over the health of the economy or the long-term health of the economy to the extent that he seemed to hint with that press release that said that, you know, there's still, there's the
we
banks
have signs
haven't
of
had
life.
Right, liquidity or margin issues, which is only the kind of thing you say when you're on the brink of a financial sort of collapse. So it does seem to have done more harm than good, unless you read it as sort of a release intended for Donald Trump to say, look, I'm working on this, I'm doing what I can to stabilize the markets, so hold tight and sort of let the markets work their way out, in which case then it makes some sense.
We have a question from Kokomo Kid, who says, does the ballooning deficit resulting from the tax cuts affect the economy? Anyone want to answer that? Ron?
Eventually, yes. There is still a reason that people are concerned about the federal government spending lots and lots of money that it does not take in, that borrows that money. A federal government headed for $1 trillion per year annual deficit, adding to a now approaching $22 trillion cumulative debt over the life of the country. You know, when Ronald Reagan was elected in 1980, one of his big issues was that we were approaching $1 trillion in accumulated debt. Now we're at almost 22 times that much, and we're running up $1 trillion.
And we borrowed a lot of that money from the country we're now in a trade war with.
Well, exactly, and this is part of the reason why going to war with China is not the world's greatest idea.
And for this year-end show, it's worth pointing out that one of the greatest ironies here is that Paul Ryan, who was perhaps more eloquent than most in Congress about highlighting the impact of deficits on the overall economy, is leaving in a few days, having overseen this dramatic uptick in the deficit.
All right, so let's move on a little bit and go next door to the Supreme Court. Ruth Bader Ginsburg was released from hospital this week after lung surgery to remove some cancerous growth. She seems to be doing fine. A press release said the 85-year-old justice was, quote, resting comfortably, and post-surgery there was no evidence of any remaining disease. Alexandra, this is not Ginsburg's first battle with cancer, and this has brought up questions about her decision to remain on the Supreme Court instead of stepping down during Obama's terms. What effect are Ginsburg's, I guess, repeated brushes with illness having?
I mean, she's got a cult following that's not going anywhere. But
notorious RBG. Yep.
Yep. But there are some Democrats coming out and saying, look, you know, you had the opportunity to leave when a Democratic president could appoint a replacement. And now that she's been in through Trump and her health seems to be declining somewhat. And mind you, I mean, she's known for exercising constantly. She's known as still being very sharp on the bench. So those concerns may be a little bit overblown, but if you do see a justice go into, you know, the hospital for major surgery, it's fair to ask those questions about whether she maybe should have stepped down when there was better opportunity to replace her, because this could give Donald Trump yet another chance to put someone on the Supreme Court and truly change the makeup for decades to come.
Well, this is your area, David. Why so much is what Alexandra's talking about, the chance that Donald Trump may get another nomination, why there's so much speculation here?
Well, that's a huge factor, but we also have to take into account what Ruth Bader Ginsburg has done in the last 2 years. Yes, politically, it may look like it would have been better in the long term if she steps aside, someone more like her judicial philosophy comes on board on the court. On the other hand, her mind is still sharp. She is still, to all of us in the country, she is still contributing to the Supreme Court in a way that we can't expect even of an average Supreme Court justice. So why is it that we should have been without her wisdom during the last 2 years and perhaps for the next two, four, who knows how many years?
I think people also forget that just retiring during the Obama presidency would not necessarily guarantee that Barack Obama would have appointed her successor. Remember what happened with Merrick Garland.
We all remember, yeah.
And we don't know at what point the Republican majority in the Senate might have been willing to use that tactic.
Okay, let's move on to something weird. Actor Kevin Spacey released what we can only describe as a bizarre video, released on Christmas Eve, which is more weird, and it seems like he took on his character from the House of Cards series on Netflix, and he was doing it as Frank Underwood.
I know what you want. You want me back. Of course, some believed everything and had just been waiting with bated breath to hear me confess it all. They're just dying to have me declare that everything said is true and that I got what I deserved. Wouldn't that be easy if it was all so simple? Only you and I both know it's never that simple, not in politics and not in life.
Okay, it's creepy. The two-time Academy Award winner was fired from the show after multiple allegations of sexual misconduct were made public in the fall of 2017, although we should mention that he is in the middle of more allegations. He's been accused of sexual misconduct by over a dozen people. David, why?
The audio you just played is chilling.
Makes the your video, skin crawl, right?
The video is haunting because of the horrible charges against him to hear those things. And I would advise listeners, if they have not watched the video and they want to end 2018 on a good note, do not watch the video. We're in a sorry state of affairs when a plausible explanation, and perhaps the most likely explanation, is that he's preparing an insanity defense by saying he can't separate his characters from his own personality. That's how far this has gone.
Your theory is that this is part of a intent to plead insanity.
It's either a sick version of trolling, given the victims and what they're saying happened, or it's setting up something where he's saying, I don't know who I am anymore, and these actions are things I can't remember and I never would have done. Maybe it was one of my characters acting through me. We're at the point where we have to consider that, because this is that haunting.
Alexandra, what do you make of it?
I mean, it also echoes this broader trend of men taken down during the Me Too movement trying to make comebacks. I mean, we've seen some of that with Matt Lauer. We saw a number of sort of local state lawmakers who were taken down by Me Too in state houses try to run for re-election. So I think we're going to continue to see men that have been accused of misconduct try to come back into the public sphere. What's a little bit different about this is it's a bizarre and, like you said, creepy way to do it.
Yeah. Ron, right?
Yes. I think we should all hope that some of the other actors who have played nefarious characters in the film and in the television industry do not adopt this strategy and start confusing themselves with some of the people they've played.
Or at least pretending to confuse themselves. We are still getting more shutdown stories. Adam writes on Facebook, I'm currently furloughed. I have worked in federal government for 6 years, and this is not the first time. I was affected by sequestration back in 2013 as well. My personal views of the cause of the shutdown aside, it is frustrating that my job and the jobs of others are used as pawns for attempted political gain. Additionally, the claim that us federal workers are pro-shutdown until a wall is funded, or that we are all Democrats, is ludicrous. I just want to do my job. I want to serve the country and get back to work. And then Jim in Pittsboro, North Carolina writes, I just turned 70 and have applied for my full Social Security benefits. With the shutdown, there's no one working at the SSA to process my request. Who knows when I might eventually receive my Social Security benefit?
You know, one of the things the president said this week that shows you a little bit of his thinking was he said that the Democrats really ought to give him what he wants so that the government can reopen, because these people who have been furloughed are their supporters.
Let's go to a happier story. Everyone knows that Santa Claus lives in the North Pole, of course, but maybe he can open a field office in Patagonia, Arizona. Randy Heiss is a resident of that town. It is near the U.S.-Mexico border. He was walking on his property when he found the tattered remains of a balloon. Attached to it was a Christmas wish list addressed to Santa, written in Spanish. So Randy and his wife began a mission to find the kid that wrote that wish list and make her Christmas dreams come true. So with the help of a Mexican radio station, they actually tracked the girl down, and then with those Christmas presents in hand, headed over the border to meet with her family. The note's author and her little sister still believe the balloon made it all the way to the North Pole, and that Randy and his wife were ayudantes de Santa, which is Santa's helpers. So, you know, still Christmas miracles, right, people?
Randy Heiss's behavior was not marginal.
It's a happy holiday story to end with. Thanks to all my guests today. Alexandra Jaffe is correspondent for Vice News Tonight on HBO. David Preece, COO of the Lawfare Institute, best known for the national security website lawfareblog.com. And Ron Elving, senior editor and correspondent for NPR. 1A's lead sound engineer is Jake Cherry. Our digital team is Catherine Fink and Gabrielle Healy. To learn more about them and the rest of the team, visit 1A.org/staff. The international section of the Friday News Roundup is just ahead.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Capital One. Here's Sarah Strauss, head of fraud at Capital One, on how the CreditWise app helps users take action after receiving one of its automatic credit alerts.
It's not just an alert, but it's also, here are the next steps that we recommend you do. And so hopefully that's giving our users the opportunity to feel empowered to go after the issue and resolve it.
CreditWise is free for everyone, whether you're a Capital One customer or not. You can find CreditWise in your app or Play Store now.
There's a new way to hear Morning Edition, All Things Considered, and all your favorite programs. Just ask your smart device to play NPR. Listen to your local station anytime, like this. Hey, smart device, play NPR.
President Trump's surprise trip to Iraq seems to have played well here, but in Iraq, it is a different story. Also, elections are delayed in some parts of the world, brought forward in others. We're going to explain why that's all happening. And it looks like the train could be about to leave the station on North Korea and South Korea peace talks. We should talk about two different Christmas Day addresses as well, both watched by millions, but only one of them involved a gold piano. Our guests for the final Friday News Roundup are Rosalind Jordan, State Department and Specials Correspondent for Al Jazeera English TV. Hello.
Hello.
Ron Nixon is International Investigations Editor for the Associated Press and author of Selling Apartheid, South Africa's Global Propaganda War. Hi, Ron.
Hi, how are you?
Good. And Natan Gutman is Washington Correspondent for Israeli Public TV. Hello.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, to the surprise of many people, the President and First Lady made an unexpected trip to visit U.S. troops in Iraq.
We're no longer the suckers, folks, and people aren't looking at us as suckers. And I love you folks because most of you are nodding your head this way. We're respected again as a nation. We're respected again.
This was Donald Trump's first visit to an active combat zone since he took office almost 2 years ago. A planned meeting with Iraq's president, though, didn't take place. Tamara Keith, who reported on the trip for NPR, says the president was given a warm welcome by U.S. troops. But Iraqi lawmakers are reportedly furious and now demanding the withdrawal of all U.S. servicemen and women. So overall, Natan, how can we sort of gauge the success of this trip?
Well, it was a success, first of all, in terms of Donald Trump himself. He was under fire for not visiting the troops. He's almost 2 years in office and he hasn't been at any active war zone. So now he put a check on that. And he's actually visited the troops and he's okay with that. And of course, there was the whole cemetery visit that he skipped during his visit to France. So definitely he's in a better position now politically. In terms of American politics, it's probably played out well. He tried to use a strip to explain the Syria withdrawal to kind of position this new type of American worldview in which you have less presence, as we heard him say, we're not the suckers of the world anymore. We're going to minimize our presence in the Middle East while staying in Iraq. So he kind of tried to rationalize this whole thing. Of course, didn't play out as well with the Iraqis, who didn't like the fact that the trip wasn't coordinated with them, who didn't like this idea of Donald Trump coming to Iraq and actually declaring that Iraq will be the front base for American operations in the Middle East.
So then, Rosalind, we get this quote from the head of one of the two main blocs in Iraq's parliament, who said, quote, Trump needs to know his limits. The American occupation of Iraq is over, end quote. Why were the Iraqi officials so furious?
Well, number one, he couldn't seem to figure out how to go 70 miles or so to the east to see the prime minister or the president or any of the officials in the parliament. And even though the White House has argued that they had tried to organize some sort of meeting with the prime minister, they couldn't get things worked out. Now, having covered the White House, I will tell you that there are always lots of plans to try to do lots of things. And for any number of reasons, including security reasons, things don't always get executed. That said, there is something for giving a gentle heads up, swearing everyone to secrecy, but at least giving them the knowledge of knowing that you are going to be visiting their country. There is a protocol breach of sorts here. There's also the sense that, once again, even though Donald Trump talks about pulling U.S. forces out of many hotspots around the world and not trying to be the world's policeman, that he is in effect extending the U.S.'s growing reputation, particularly in the Middle East, that the U.S. wants to be an occupying power, that it wants to be involved in domestic politics and in shaping and orchestrating every country's foreign policy so that it redounds positively to Washington's benefit and not so much to, in this case, Baghdad's benefit. So this specter of we're not being colonialists, but we are acting as colonialists is really rubbing a lot of Iraqis the wrong way.
It also, because of the surprise nature of it, although you mentioned secrecy and a number of people in England reported seeing Air Force One.
It's kind of hard to miss.
Yeah.
Air Force One has flown.
It's a big plane.
It's a big plane. It's, if you've ever flown on Air Force One, there's nothing like it. You can't miss it. It has flown over my house.
Yeah, there's not a whole lot of planes painted that way.
There are not a whole lot. Thank you, Jackie Kennedy. But it doesn't, you can't miss it. You can't avoid it. And obviously, people are going to be taking pictures of the sky in light of something else that was happening in the UK.
So, Ron, what are we to make of the timing? Do we think that if there had been no shutdown, if General Mattis had not resigned as defense secretary, that the president would still have made this trip to Iraq?
It's hard to speculate. I am of the mind that he probably would have, because he has been getting a lot of criticism for not visiting a war zone. And there were even stories suggesting that he was afraid to do so. And if we know one thing about the president, is that you don't challenge him on certain things, particularly what he considers manly. Right.
Yeah.
And so I think he would have gone. Anyway, I think the larger point here is that he got a lot of criticism, particularly from former military, about this trip almost becoming a campaign rally with people with the Make America Great Again hats and one
officer.
We
should establish that it is not general practice for a president to talk about any political matters while speaking to troops.
Because you do not politicize the military. That has been our standard for years, that you go into a war zone where these young men and women are, you know, putting their lives on the line. And basically, you're, as commander in chief, you're coming in and telling them that, you know, this is, I'm here to support you and what you're doing
regardless.
To support our country.
All right, let's talk a little bit more broadly then about policy, and especially since we learned that President Trump has decided to withdraw troops from Syria. Not pretty, but at least done. That was the quote from Trump's former chief strategist, Steve Bannon. He was speaking in Iraq this week. The president made it very clear that America's military involvement in Syria, at least, is over.
There will be a strong, deliberate, and orderly withdrawal of U.S. forces from Syria, very deliberate, very orderly, while maintaining the U.S. presence in Iraq to prevent an ISIS resurgence and to protect U.S. interests, and also to always watch very closely over any potential reformation of ISIS, and also to watch over Iran. We'll be watching.
We'll be watching Iran, Tan. Does this fact that the U.S. is pulling out of Syria and now might draw down troops in Afghanistan, are there concerns that on the other end this will actually empower Iran?
Well, of course there are, because even though the American mission in Syria was defined as fighting ISIS, it was clear that while you have American troops on the ground and all the support system around them with the Air Force and with the logistics, there is a presence there that blocks Iran or stops Iran from building this basically land bridge all the way from Iran through Syria and Lebanon into the Mediterranean. And the United States didn't engage in fighting with Iran, but the fact that they were there was seen as a way of blocking Iran. Now that the United States is out, basically Syria is under the control of Russia. And the Russians, it's not really clear that Russia at this point is interested in curbing Iran in any way. Maybe they will be if Iran emboldens and feels more emboldened in Syria. But right now, Russia isn't blocking them. The United States is moving out. So Iran is definitely a stronger power in the region.
And then there's also concerns, Rosalind, about Turkey. On Monday, President Trump spoke to his Turkish counterpart on the phone. And those who were involved or in the room, I guess, told reporters that Donald Trump told Erdogan, OK, it's all yours. We are done. And then Turkey made promises to finish off ISIS. What are we to make of what happens with Turkey in light of U.S. decisions to withdraw troops?
Well, it's one thing to assume that Ankara would actually go after the remaining threads of ISIL fighters in northeastern Syria. But the bigger concern is the Kurdish fighters who are part of the YPG, which is affiliated with the PKK, which is a group which both the United States and Turkey consider a terrorist group. The PKK, in Ankara's eyes, is an existential threat to the existence of the Turkish government. And Erdogan has made it his life's mission to go after the PKK in whatever form possible. The fear is that he is going to unleash his troops to go into Syria to go after these Kurdish fighters who had been trained by the United States, we should point out, to fight ISIL. And the thanks that the United States is now giving to these Kurdish fighters is being slaughtered by the Turkish military. That is a very, very real fear. And it is something which a lot of U.S. military officials did not want to see happen, which is why they did not want to have this pullout of the 2,000 U.S. troops inside Syria to happen in the first place. And that leads to why Secretary Mattis and Brett McGurk, the special envoy, both said, that's it, we're done.
So, Ben, how do we square this with comments the president made last year when he said America's enemies must never know our plans, right? Because he's announced plans in both Syria and in Afghanistan.
I think you can just expect that anytime the president says something, he's going to go back and contradict himself. I think there's ample evidence now over the 2 years of his presidency so far that he is going to change because it is much more expeditious at that moment.
So Wednesday morning, a train left South Korea and 27 minutes later arrived in North Korea. Less than a half an hour, but its significance was greater than that. I think it's fair to say the trip recognized the groundbreaking for work to repair and reopen that railway that once connected the two countries, which are technically both still at war. So, Ron, how important is this train trip, this 27-minute trip?
I think it's symbolic, but it is significantly symbolic in that it does show a further easing of the tension between the two countries. And to have, you know, lawmakers from South Korea and family members who have family in North Korea travel on this train into North Korea, it's a first step in this easing between easing of hostilities between the two. But that being said, there's a lot of work that still has to be done here because you remember North Korea is still under international sanctions. And so it's not like they're going to just say, hey, you know what, let's fix this and have trains going back and forth, because the sanctions are in place. And plus, because of the sanctions and a number of other factors, North Korea rail and road systems is dilapidated. And it would take billions of dollars probably to upgrade it to a point where you would have trains going back and forth and having normal travel.
We also saw reports that about 1,000 North Korean defectors had their personal data leaked after a computer at a South Korean resettlement center was hacked. Maybe another indication that this is not going to be the easiest transition?
Well, definitely. I mean, we see here opposing forces, basically. On the one hand, even with the train, there is this wish on behalf of South Korea to expedite this reunification process as much as possible. On the other hand, there's this pushback from the international community, even from the United States, saying, wait a second, trains are nice, but what about nuclear proliferation and what about ballistic missiles? So that's pulling back. And also in the behavior of the North Koreans, on the one hand, we see these gestures. On the other hand, there's this breach of data. 1,000 files of North Korean defectors to the south were hacked. We know what the North Koreans think about the defectors. They call them human scum. There is a real concern that if they reach their names and details, and these are 1,000, but there are 33,000 in the database, these people might be in harm's way. We've seen defectors disappear and reappear after in North Korea. So definitely Kim Jong-un is playing this on both sides of the game. He's on the one hand going forward with these public gestures. On the other hand, there is this covert operation that may be undermining the whole negotiation.
And I want to touch on something that Don just raised, the idea that these people might be in physical jeopardy. Let's not forget, we're talking about a country that had the president's half-brother murdered.
Yeah.
A couple of years ago.
If and reports so, are correct, quite violently.
Quite violently. And so this is, it's quite alarming that there could be this sort of security breach, especially given that the North Koreans were suspected of breaching Sony's software, you know, for millions of people using PlayStation and having to give over their information. But again, getting that information to show that, yes, we can undermine you, we can pervade your sense of security. But in this case, we're talking about actual lives. I mean, people try to get across the DMZ in the most harrowing of circumstances. They're escaping forced starvation and forced labor, forced abortion. And the idea that they can't be physically safe does raise questions, particularly for the government in Seoul, to do a better job of protecting these people.
Let's move to Africa for the moment. The Democratic Republic of Congo is gearing up for its first democratic election in decades. The outgoing president, Joseph Kabila, is stepping down after more than 15 years in office. Things have gotten messy, as they are sometimes wont to do. Now, Ron, Kabila was supposed to leave a couple years ago. Remind us of why that didn't happen and then why it is happening now.
Well, so Joseph Kabila was supposed to leave 2 years ago, and he postponed the elections for 2 years for a number of reasons, which nobody actually believes. That there is, you know, one was we don't have the infrastructure in place to actually carry out the elections. And then, well, we need time. And then it was problems with the opposition and who was qualified to run in the elections. So all of these reasons were given. And now the elections are going forward, except for in three cities where they say that the Congolese government say that it's because there's an Ebola outbreak, which is true.
Yes.
And this is the second deadliest Ebola outbreak in the history of the country. But they also say there are claims of terrorism. Now, it's weird that all of these cities just happen to be where the opposition is. And so they can't vote until March of next year. According to what the government is saying, until they can deal with the problem of the Ebola and deal with the problem of terrorism.
And yet the election will go forward on December 30th. Right. It's supposed to be certified on January 15th,
right.
But then the people in these three provinces can't vote until mid-March. Well,
who are they voting for?
Right.
You know, it's you know, very much Mr. Kabila is coming under a lot of criticism, and he's being questioned about it quite vigorously by a number of news organizations, including my own, about these delay tactics simply being a way to extend his hold on power. You know, he's pretty much done nothing else with his adult life except be the leader of the DRC.
So then in Israel, Natan, that presidential election is actually coming earlier than was planned. They're now going to be held in April instead of next November. Why?
Well, because Prime Minister Netanyahu decided this is a good point in time to dissolve the Knesset, the Israeli parliament, and move ahead with elections. It's common practice in Israel. A prime minister, a Knesset, is elected for 4 years, but usually it dissolves earlier. And why is this a good point for Netanyahu? Because he's under at least four investigations of corruption. Three of them are nearing indictments. And Netanyahu fears, to a certain extent, that this is a good point to stop, to go to the people and say, look, you like what I'm doing. He's a pretty popular prime minister. He views himself and his followers view him as Mr. Security, as the only leader who can deal with Israel's defense challenges. And said, you know, vote for me now, and then we'll see what comes out of these investigations.
What is he accused of?
Well, he's accused of several cases of corruption. Two of them have to do actually with the with the media, his attempts to seek a more favorable media coverage from main media outlets in return for legislation and regulations that will benefit the owners of these media outlets. One of them has to do just with receiving endless gifts, cigars and champagne from American donors. One of them that will probably lead to nothing right now has to do with the corruption surrounding the purchase of submarines for the Israeli Navy. But all of them together, of course, paint a picture of a prime minister who's under attack and under siege. And that's why we see, first of all, we see, of course, something that's similar to American politics. We see an attack on the legal system, on the attorney general, on the justice, and also an attempt to bypass that and go to the voters and say, look, if you like what I'm doing, just ignore all these corruption accusations.
Do we expect that will work? Do we expect Netanyahu to be reelected in April?
Well, it's complicated because it's a coalition system, and it's not enough for him for his Likud party to get enough votes. They have to have the bloc that can actually create it. Right now, he seems to be polling pretty well, and we could expect to see the same coalition. But 4 months is a long time.
It is. Okay, so then let's move back to Africa. In Sudan, protesters are now calling for the resignation of President Omar al-Bashir. They were tear gassed by police. The protests, though, continued to ripple throughout that country for the second week. So let's take a look and listen to NPR's East Africa correspondent, Ider Peralta, talking about those protests on Morning Edition. He's speaking with host David Green.
So that's what people across Sudan are chanting, and it translates roughly to the people demand the fall of the regime. And if you remember, that was a hugely popular chant during the Arab Spring.
Sure.
And the Sudanese, they took to the streets back then too. And since 2011, people have taken to the streets, and every single time the security forces have managed to tamp these protests down.
Razan, can we call these sudden protests? Did they come out of nowhere?
They didn't come out of nowhere. It's been brewing for a while, but I think that people are finally starting to say, you know what, we're fed up. Our standard of living is no good. People have been leaving, trying to migrate to Europe to try to find a better quality of life. People don't feel that they have their civil liberties or their human rights being respected. Of course, Omar al-Bashir is under international sanction for violating people's political rights, for disappearing people, for killing political opponents. And despite the efforts of the United States and Western Europe to treat him as a pariah, he has been welcomed in other parts of the world. So there is this sense that someone needs to be held accountable for his behavior. I fear it's going to become much bloodier before things are resolved, because he has been in power for a long time. He has a very strong military and internal security apparatus, and it's not the safest of places to live if you want to stand up and say, well, I have a different view of how our government should be run if you're in Sudan.
Ron, do we expect the protests to result in any kind of political change in Sudan?
I think in this case, yes, because there are several things that are different than protests in the past. One, the pound there has dropped in value. Two, the price of bread and fuel has risen there too. And inflation is killing people there. And three, the country is not as secure as it was economically because of the creation of South Sudan. So a lot of the oil revenue, when the country of South Sudan was created, a lot of that oil revenue is there. So now he doesn't have that in place to sort of keep, you know, people in line. So I think you will see some changes. What kind of changes, I can't say, but I suspect it will be something to sort of placate people. But I think this will just grow as time move forward, because, you know, again, people are desperate now.
All right, two other stories that we're watching in Asia and the Far East. First, there's the ongoing effort to help those who are impacted by a volcanic eruption last weekend. That triggered a massive tsunami in Indonesia. More than 430 people were killed. Rescue workers still searching for some of those victims. Even as state officials have issued another tsunami alert for this weekend. Second, we've got Japan's decision this week to withdraw from the International Whaling Commission and resume commercial whaling. Natan, do we have any idea why they backtracked on their decision to stop commercial whaling?
Well, Japan claims basically that, first of all, this treaty didn't really fulfill what it was supposed to do. It didn't regulate in a proper way the killing of whales that Japanese would want to see. They say, well, we accept the fact that we have to limit it and limit the number of whales being killed. But still, you have to respect the fact that this is part of our economy and part of our tradition, and that's why we want to continue with this. Now, also, it wasn't very effective because there was this waiver in the agreement that allowed Japan to conduct whaling for research purposes, and it's not really clear what kind of research they conducted, but what is obvious is that they did sell the whale meat afterwards. So basically, they were killing 300-plus whales a year as it is, so it didn't really, the ban wasn't complete and wasn't effective. Now, dropping out of it, which was, of course, internationally condemned by all activists and governments, would actually limit Japan to whaling in its own waters and not in the Arctic or in Australia.
But that leads to the question, Rosalind, why bother to drop out of it, right? If they were already killing whales under this guise of scientific research and hundreds of them anyway, why would Japan sort of thumb its nose at the international community? I mean, we have to remember the reason this moratorium was put in place because a number of whale species were hunted to extinction or close to extinction.
That's right. I looked up some of the numbers of the whales that Japan would be able to resume targeting or hunting. Brady's whales, and I may be saying that name wrong, we're not clear how many still exist, but in the southern hemisphere, there may be 200, 300 near extinction. Whales don't breed very often, very in high numbers, so this is a very worrisome number. The International Whaling Commission also doesn't know how many, say, whales still exist in the Northwest Pacific, where Japan is. There are about 25,000 minke whales, but again, as Natan said, they can only go after the whales that are within their specific economic fishing zone around the Japanese islands. And they still say they're going to try to help out with a little bit of research. I think they're playing to this very strong nationalist strain in some parts of the Japanese body politic. I think, by appealing to this idea of tradition, and this is, sustaining ourselves. I think it's also part of a larger global phenomenon of countries pulling out of international organizations and treaties. I mean, it can be argued that the U.S. has sort of set that tone by pulling out of the Paris Climate Accord and by threatening to perhaps pull out of NATO. You now see Hungary suggesting that it may not bother trying to become a member of the EU. You see Qatar pulling out of OPEC. There seems to be this real sense of countries saying we can manage these issues better on our own rather than a global entity because our rights are not being respected within these international organizations.
Which would suggest that we may see more of this pulling out of treaties.
We may see that.
Our listeners can't see, but all three of our guests are nodding at this point. We have a lot more still coming, including the fallout over the Queen's holiday speech and her glistening gold piano. This is 1A. I'm Celeste Headlee. Stay close.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from the YMCA, a nonprofit committed to strengthening communities. The Y believes the zip code you're born into shouldn't determine your destiny and works to create opportunity for all, no matter who you are or where you're from. Learn more about the impact of your donation at ymca.net/forabetterus. The Y, for a better us.
Hi, this is Peter Sagal. For 20 years, Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me has been making fun of the news with comedians and celebrity guests. We got silly limericks, we got terrible impressions. If you think the news is a joke, wait till you hear our show. New podcast episodes are available every Saturday.
Let's go to Rome. On Tuesday, the Pope delivered his Christmas Day address. It was a message of compassion and unity. It was one that was delivered at a time, as we have alluded to already, of rising nationalism around the world and anti-immigrant sentiment, especially in Europe and in the U.S. His theme for the year was fraternity.
Fraternità tra le persone di ogni nazione e cultura.
Fraternity, he says, among individuals of every nation and culture, fraternity among people with different ideas, yet capable of respecting and listening to one another, fraternity among persons of different religions. Jesus came to reveal the face of God to all those who seek him. Rosalind, the Pope hasn't had a banner year. It's been difficult. For him, he's going to face some key tests in 2019. When he became Pope, people expected him to be a real reformer and truly change the face of the church. Is there still a possibility that's true?
Pope Francis is at perhaps the most real of turning points, if I can say that. The ongoing problem of pedophilia, of sexual abuse, by covering up, moving people around. It is clear now, after more than 20 years, this is an institutional problem. This is not, as his predecessor, Pope John Paul II, said, just a symptom of the depravity of U.S. culture. When the scandal first broke in Massachusetts in the 1990s, I was covering it then. This is something that has become an issue on pretty much every continent except Antarctica. And the Pope himself has been implicated in, if not actively covering up the abuses, at least turning away while his subordinates in South America carried out the cover-up, the moving around of problematic priests, the failure to report sexual abuse and rape to the authorities, to fail to seek prosecutions, to basically push away the very parishioners that the Roman Catholic Church depends on for its existence. He is supposed to meet in Vatican City in February with bishops from around the world to talk about once and for all, how do we break up this culture of protecting the abusers and blaming the abused and violated. And there is a growing sense that he may not be up to the task, in part because the Vatican itself is a very political organization. There is a very small but growing movement here in the United States among some Catholics to say, we, the parishioners, we, the laity, we, the ordinary men and women of the church, need to have a say, and we need to be at the table to try to change this culture. We cannot trust the priests, and we cannot trust the Holy Father to make these changes. We can't trust Rome.
So he took a trip to Chile. That was widely expected to be good for him.
And it was terrible.
Went badly. Basically, kind of the same thing happened to Ireland. What keeps going wrong?
It seems that this is an institutional problem, that in order to preserve the church's position in all of these countries around the world, to continue to try to expand its ranks, particularly in sub-Saharan Africa, that the very human bad behavior, because remember, the church, like any organization, is made up of people, we have to overlook that bad behavior, no matter how awful it is and how illegal it is. We even have the Attorney General for the District of Columbia, Carl Racine, suggesting that what people say to priests in confession, which has up until now been protected from any purview of law enforcement, should now be made public. If a priest is told of abuse, that the priest should become a mandated reporter. So this is a real turning point for Pope Francis and for the Roman Catholic Church.
Let's take a look at two other quick stories out of Europe this week. Both, I think, deserve a second look. London's Gatwick Airport was shut down just before Christmas. There were multiple reports of drones hovering near the runway. 67 reports of this. The British Transport Minister, Chris Grayling, not amused.
It's pretty clear that this is a fairly large drone that is clearly being operated deliberately in a way that every time Gatwick tries to reopen the runway, the drones reappear. So this is quite clearly a deliberate act. And anybody who does this should expect to go to jail for many years.
Those reports were taken seriously. A very large reward was offered. Two people were arrested. They had their pictures plastered on the front pages, only to be released without charge. And then one of the officers involved in the case told the BBC there's a possibility the sightings were mistaken and there was no drone. I'm sorry, London, to laugh. Ron, what's going on?
Good question. Because, you know, December 20th, this airport shut down for 2 days. Thousands of flights were canceled. You know, right before Christmas. So obviously this is a huge deal because it's the second busiest airport in the UK and the eighth busiest in Europe. So this is a huge deal. We still don't know what happened, though.
Or if there were drones.
Or if there were actual drones in the airport, because again, as you say, a lot of people claim to have saw a drone. And two people were arrested and later exonerated that they weren't the people. So there's still an ongoing investigation into if there actually was a drone. And they're still questioning people about what they saw. I haven't seen any footage that indicates that there actually was a drone. I don't think they've shown any footage. So we're just back where we were before when the airport first shut down. We don't know. But this also points to a larger problem of having drones where you can go and buy a drone.
That's
from
the thing,
Best Buy,
right?
And anybody can buy one. You can fly them all over the place. There's countries have tried to put in some rules for them, including the U.S. The FAA has tried to put in some rules for flying drones. And there's been pushback on that because they have commercial use and scientific use. So, you know, they're useful for all of those reasons, but you don't want drones flying around in the airspace, in any airport. Because it's dangerous.
This is also a cautionary tale for other airports, right?
Of course, and I think it goes to show us how difficult it is to catch up with the technology, because this basically is a very simple thing. As Ron said, you can buy it at Best Buy, and in 5 minutes it's up in the air. And even though airport security is so extensive and we have these elaborate systems that can shoot down a rocket in the sky, still then you're faced with this toy drone and you don't know what to do, and you have to shut down a major airport in Europe because of these sightings or potential sightings of the drone. So definitely there's a lot of catching up to do with technology, even when that technology isn't that advanced, and it comes to show us how sometimes we're set in our notions about what security means and what defense means.
Okay, so for this next story, you need to know that the German newspaper Der Spiegel is a big deal. It is one of the country's most often cited publications. It's a big deal internationally, but it turns out that one of their star reporters has been making things up whole cloth for years. He resigned on Monday. He was an award-winning journalist, included among CNN's Journalist of the Year. He was on Forbes' list of 30 under 30. One of the paper's editors said the discovery marked the low point in the 70-year history of Der Spiegel. And Rosalind, interestingly enough, it was two residents of a small town in Minnesota, Ron is cheering, who, not reporters, who outed this guy. What are we to make of this? That he's been making stuff up completely.
There's so much to unpack here. First, he went to this town. Stayed there for 3 weeks and wrote a story saying that not only was this a town that wholeheartedly supported Donald Trump, but apparently had a sign that says "Mexicans keep out" at the entrance to the city, which does not exist. It did not exist. He portrayed the residents of this town as being racist, jingoistic, isolationist, ignorant, every possible stereotype that you could trot out about Americans was packed into this one story. And when people heard about the story, they actually took the time to get a professional translation of the article, which was on the website in German. And then they circulated it. And so the entire town was just outraged that they could be so misrepresented, that someone could just lie about it. But they never really got any pushback or sorry from Der Spiegel. Well, now it has evolved that this 33-year-old reporter, and I think the age is important, apparently had been writing a number of stories that had made-up sources, made-up quotes, made-up facts, and a colleague who was reporting with him on the southwest border between the U.S. and Mexico said, this is a problem. They outed him.
And so, Ron, we have this example of an internationally renowned reporter being outed by a couple non-journalists in a tiny little town, which he described as being in the middle of the forest, but was actually in the middle of the prairies of Minnesota.
Yeah, we don't have many forests in Minnesota.
You have lakes.
From Minnesota. We have lots of lakes, of lakes. We'll call anything with water in it a lake. I can say that I'm from Minnesota. But I think this speaks to a larger point about the ability for regular people to push back, given the reach of the web and social media. At one point, this thing probably would never have been discovered. I mean, obviously, you have had his colleague saying that some of the things that he was saying in the story that they wrote about the southwest border, I never saw that. But to be able to push back against publications like, this is, like as you said, this publication has an international reputation. It's known for its investigative reporting. It's known for its narrative journalism. But for not, if it wasn't for the web, people would not have the recourse that they have to be able to push back on this. I mean, you could complain to the publication and they probably would have stood by their reporter, which actually they did when the other reporter said, hey, you know, there's a problem here. But it also speaks to this star system, because you've seen that at other publications, like when USA Today had the problem with Jack Kelly and people at the paper raised the issue. Brian Williams. They were saying, hey, I mean, it's your star reporter. So, of course, they're going to the first instinct is to protect them. But I also think that because it's this foreign publication, it's in German, he didn't think that anyone would actually read it. And therefore,
anyone from the U.S.
And that they wouldn't be able to read it. And so he would continue to get the accolades that he did for his narrative journalism. I would disagree with some folks who say this is a problem with narrative journalism and all the other ridiculous arguments that have been made. If you go to a place for 3 weeks and report, you can get all sorts of facts and color for
this. Why'd you have to make it up?
Why even go? I mean, if you're going to go and make things up.
Just wanted to add, as a foreign journalist, first of all, we live in a reality in which even if you write for a publication half the world away in a foreign language, everyone is going to see it. You know, right. We broadcast a small TV station in the Middle East speaking Hebrew. You can still see everything online, so you're accountable for everything that you do. And also, of course, it seems just based on the stories that he fabricated that the bigger problem was that he went into these stories with a certain mindset. Right. He was out there to show the Minnesotans, the racist Minnesotans supposedly who support Trump, and he didn't let the facts ruin a good story.
He made up complete people.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Okay. So, in any case, before we go, pray a little silence for Her Majesty the Queen.
It's been a busy year for my family, with 2 weddings and 2 babies, and another child expected soon. It helps to keep a grandmother well occupied.
Okay, every year at 3 p.m. on Christmas Day, millions of Brits turn on the TV to hear from the Queen. It wasn't what she said that made news, though. In the TV shot over the Queen's shoulder was a glistening, bright gold piano, and some thought that was too much. Many people took to Twitter. They poured scorn on the Queen. They talked about self-sacrifice, but also then played up the monarch's vast wealth. Others seemed amazed at the outrage. That would include me, asking if they'd rather have seen her wearing Santa PJs in a room furnished by IKEA. Is the Queen out of touch, Ron?
It's the Queen. I mean, if you're going to have a conversation about a monarchy in the 21st century, I think that's valid. But if you're going to have a monarchy in the 21st century and you're complaining about her having a gold piano, it's the queen. What else would she have? I'm just like, what else would the queen have?
If she rolled it out front Buckingham Palace and set it on fire, people would be mad about that. I mean, come on.
I'm sorry.
She's the queen of England. She's
what was your first clue when she was broadcasting from Buckingham Palace?
She's supposed to have a gold piano.
Exactly. By definition, the queen is out of touch. She lives in the palace and she wears the crown jewels.
Right. Yes. Okay. A very big thank you to all three of our guests. Rosalind Jordan is State Department and Specialist Correspondent for Al Jazeera English TV. Ron Nixon, International Investigations Editor for the Associated Press. And Natan Gutman, Washington Correspondent for Israeli Public TV. A reminder, we want your suggestions for shows and topics for the new year. That's a tradition that you get to set the agenda for January. So if you think a story needs more airtime, find us online at the1a.org and click on Ask. 1A. 1A's senior producers are Gabe Bullard, Lindsay Thomas, Denise Couture, and Danielle Knight. Our podcast editor is Miranda Fulmore. To learn more about them and the rest of our team, visit the1a.org/staff. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Celeste Headlee. Thank you so much for listening. This is 1A.